Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mehler here, and we're starting this show today by talking about the power of science for you to use to produce healthier fruits and vegetables. And our guest is Robert Pavlis. Robert is a master gardener, an award-winning author, has 11 gardening books. He has degrees in chemistry and biochemistry, teaches many gardening courses, and has written articles for many popular magazines, such as Mother Earth News. And his latest book, the one we'll be talking about today, is titled Food Science for Gardeners: Grow, Harvest, and Prepare Nutrient-Dense Food. So we'll ask him about food safety, about handling and storing, preserving and growing, of course, all with nutrition in mind. And as I talk with him, I hope you'll join in with your questions. What would you like to know about growing healthy fruits and vegetables? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Robert Pavlis, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, thanks very much. It's great to be here.
So I really have enjoyed reading your book. You know, science and chemistry, it can be, well, let's see, let me put it this way. I've interviewed chemists and biochemists on the show in the past, and some of them are really good at it, and others can make science sound sometimes almost incomprehensible. But you do a very good job of explaining it so that even somebody like me can understand it. And and you do it in an entertaining way. So thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you very much.
Why do gardeners need to know about nutrition?
Well, I guess they don't really need to know about it. Sorry about that. And I think most new gardeners don't bother with it, right? They just worry about actually growing the vegetables. And that's fine. And I think that's actually a very good approach. But I think as gardeners get more experienced, they start thinking about the food they're growing, and they want more nutrition in their food. The other thing is it's not just for gardeners. They're just people in general don't know a lot about the nutrition, about the food they buy, right? So even if you're a gardener, you're still going to the grocery store to buy things. And it's a combination of those things. And so then how do you process that? How do you take care of it? How do you pick healthy food and so on? And I guess you could look at it from the point of view that if you're going to grow your own food, one of the main goals is to produce something that's healthy to eat, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it makes sense. And I guess it's easy to say, grow better fruits and vegetables, but figuring out what that means isn't necessarily easy, is it?
No, in fact, it's very hard for a gardener to do that. Partly because there's very little information available. One of the things that I had never realized until I wrote the book was that the whole science of nutrition is quite a new science. It's not like some of the other things like chemistry and physics that have been around for hundreds of years. Nutrition is very new. And yet the headlines we see in newspapers make it sound as if scientists know all about nutrition. And so the headlines are always recommending things. The actual fact is our knowledge about nutrition is still very small. And we're just starting to get some of the important pieces of this out. So it's very difficult to get the information that we really want.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you surprised by what you found when you were kind of researching the book?
It's interesting. Whenever I write one of these books, I always learn a whole bunch. So there's always surprises. Probably the biggest surprise to me was that there's not even a proper definition of what nutrition is. Right. You would think from the headlines, like, we know all this. And we do know some things. We know about vitamins and we know about minerals, and we're starting to understand things about antioxidants. But the reality is that we know very little, and there's no accepted definition of what nutritious is. So when someone says, you know, an orange is more nutritious than an apple, it's kind of meaningless, because we can't actually define what that means, and we don't actually have the ability to measure that. Okay, so that was probably the biggest surprise to me, that it's very difficult to even define these things. And the things we do talk about are just the parts, the nutrient compounds that we know about, right? So we have about 20 that we talk about, all the minerals, calcium and phosphorus. We have the vitamins. So there's like, you know, half a dozen of those or so. And then we're starting to talk about some of the others, but there's like 5,000 nutrients that are important for our health. We don't even know what that number is yet. We think it's somewhere around 5,000. That's a guess. But there's 5,000 compounds, and they're all important for our health. And most of them, we have no idea what they do in our bodies, but we suspect that they're important for us.
Right? You do, you know, one of the fun parts of reading your book is at various points you go through myths about, right. And myth busting, and my eyebrows went up more than once. You start the book with a great one: if you can't pronounce it, don't eat it. And you say, no, just disregard that. Now, explain that.
Well, I think our society has a couple misconceptions. One is that anything that's a chemical is harmful. Right. So we talk about, a carrot is being good for us, but chemicals are bad for us. And most chemicals have names that the average person can't pronounce. So there's a lot of people who go around and say, well, geez, you know, just eat the healthy things. Like calcium, we can say, and that's good for you. But if you can't pronounce the word, don't eat it. It's not healthy. That's completely wrong. And in fact, I start the book, I think, with all the things in, I think they were bananas, and all the chemicals in bananas or carrots. It doesn't matter what you pick, anything you eat. There's thousands of these chemicals, and you can't pronounce the names of most of those things. And yet all of those chemicals are extremely important for us to eat. Okay, so the name of something, how it's pronounced, and the fact that it's a chemical has nothing to do with nutrition.
Okay. One of the reasons, I think one of the main reasons we grow our own food is to get better quality.
Right.
But do we?
It depends how you define quality. So if you define quality as being fresh food, then that's one of the biggest advantages of growing it yourself. So I can grow beans in the garden. I can pick them at the ripeness that I really like. Okay. And I can go to the garden and pick them, and I can eat them in the garden, or I can bring them in the kitchen and eat them right away. And that's the big advantage. Now, if we define quality as being very nutritious, then we have to ask the question, is the bean from my garden more nutritious than the bean I can get at the local grocery store? And the answer to that is, we really don't know. All right. It's quite possible that the bean in the grocery store was grown in better conditions than I'm growing in my backyard, which makes it more nutritious. But the bottom line is, we have no way of measuring that. I can't pick up two beans and say, okay, this one's more nutritious than this other one. It might look fresher. It's, you know, it's not wrinkled. It's not overripe and so on. But as far as nutrition goes, I have really no way to know which of those are more nutritious.
Yeah.
So I think the quality aspect really comes down to that freshness and I can pick them the way I want. So let's go with tomatoes, for instance. I mean, people complain about tomatoes in the grocery store. They don't taste very good. And one of the reasons is that those tomatoes get picked very early, and they're not fully ripe when they're in the grocery store. And it's a cultivar that's been grown for shipping so that they don't get bruised, because nobody's going to buy a bruised tomato in the grocery store. So that becomes really critical for farmers. We have to grow these tomatoes. We have to ship them across the country. They can't get bruised. They can't be mushy. They have to be in a firm condition. And so we've bred them that way. Now, as a gardener, I can go and say, well, I prefer my tomatoes riper. I want them redder. And as a gardener, I can go out and select varieties that I really like the taste of. So I can grow things that are not practical for a farmer to grow. And so I can choose that tomato. And of course, that's quality, right? Flavor, color, all of that is part of that quality equation. And I can pick one that I really like. In fact, I like tomatoes because if you ask, you know, three people about what is your favorite tomato, and they're all gardeners, so they've grown various ones, they all have a different answer, right? I love the Sweet 100 cherry tomato. And I've been growing it for almost 50 years. And it's, to me, it's the very best tomato that is ever made. But I have friends who swear by yellow tomatoes, which I've never really cared for. Okay? But they really like them. They taste good. They grow them and so on. They have their favorite. I have my favorite. And we might garden right next to each other. Okay? So that's one aspect of gardening that you just can't get from a grocery store, right? In a grocery store, you might have three types, and that's about it.
Yeah. One advantage, and you do point this out in the book, for those tomatoes that are grown for the grocery store market, is that you can get a fresh tomato in January in Wisconsin.
That's right. You can get fresh tomatoes and any other fruit all year long. And if we look at this from a nutrition point of view, that's actually a big advantage. Let's take something like that we understand an orange has vitamin C in it. I can get those all year long. And so I can get my vitamin C even in the wintertime. Right? That didn't happen 100 years ago. 100 years ago, oranges were available for a month, maybe 2 months, and that was it. You didn't get any more. So even though we complain a lot about the quality in our store, the availability is tremendous these days. And part of that, again, has to do with the fact that we've created cultivars that ship really well.
Yeah.
Right? And I know people who eat those fruits and vegetables don't really like them as much, but the fact that you can get them all year and you can get the nutrition you want all year long is a great plus.
Marie in Waukesha has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Marie.
Well, hi there. So last winter, in the summer, I raised my vegetables in a raised bed. So I put in good organic soil, and I bought the same organic soil last winter and grew peas and beans, and they were flavorless. And the only thing I can think of is it's got to be the light. That's the only thing that was different.
So you grew the beans and peas indoors in the same soil that you grew them in outside, and the flavor changed, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I have the little LED or whatever grow lights.
Yeah. All right. Well, Robert, what's your thought?
Okay, well, let's first look at the light. I see a lot of people saying I'm growing things indoors under LED lights, or they call them grow lights. There's a wide range of grow lights available. Everything from lights that are so strong that they actually match the light from the sun, to ones that most gardeners buy, which have almost no light at all. To our eyes, they look very bright, but that doesn't mean they're bright from the plant's perspective. Most of the lower cost LED lights and grow lights that are available on the market are very low light level lamps, which means the plants aren't getting enough light. And that is a real problem. And the environment, both temperature and light, is really important for growth and for flavor in vegetables. So I'm not entirely surprised that they perhaps don't taste as well. They don't taste as good when they're grown indoors. I'm sure light has a lot to do with it. The other thing, of course, is the fertilizing. Now, in your case, it sounds as if you've grown them in the same soil and the same fertilizer, so that may not be an issue. A lot of people will grow outside in real soil, and now nutrient levels are really important. And people who grow indoors in pots and soilless mixes or hydroponically, they have a very hard time keeping nutrient levels at the correct level. And if you don't do that, then you'll again suffer as far as the plant growth goes and as far as the flavor goes.
Hmm. Interesting. Marie, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We're talking today with Robert Pavlis. Robert's book is titled Food Science for Gardeners and subtitle Grow, Harvest, and Prepare Nutrient-Dense Food. Great to have him with us, and you can join in, too. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Talking with Robert Pavlis, his book titled Food Science for Gardeners. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in with your own thoughts at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. And let's go to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Mary Kay, thank you for calling.
Hi, I used to garden. I go to the store now. I'm noticing that the top part of the state of Wisconsin has everything you want. It's got different kinds of squashes, tomatoes, blueberries, grapes, everything. But from the middle on down, the stores don't have any yellow tomatoes, no different kinds of squashes, different kinds of avocados, different kinds of head lettuce. You know, the grapes and the melon aren't local. So I don't understand why the top part of the state is all healthy, but the rest isn't.
Well, the rest isn't. Well,
I don't have a comment. I don't know what kind of stores you have. It may be due to what is grown locally. Is it possible that the northern part of the state is growing some of these things locally and the southern part is not? And so the stores in the northern part have easier access to that kind of food?
There may be some of those foods more locally available, and the grocery stores that's larger, perhaps, in the more densely populated areas, are, you know, zeroing in on fewer varieties.
Right. Yeah, the larger chains certainly will buy their fruits and vegetables from other places and bring them in large quantities. So that may have a lot to do with it.
I'm not sure. She did mention also about acid and yellow tomatoes having less acid. And I wanted to bring that up because you spent a bit of time talking about acidity in tomatoes. Let's get into that a bit, Robert.
Okay. So just to explain to people, one of my passions is myth busting gardening topics, which I've been doing for many, many years. The question is there such a thing as an acid tomato? And of course, a lot of people think there are. And experts in tomatoes and in gardening have looked at this and decided, no, there's no such thing as an acid tomato. They all have almost the same pH. So I looked at it and I found, well, in fact, that's not really true. It's confusing if you don't know what pH is. So pH sounds like just a number. And the range in tomatoes goes, I have to guess here, but 4.3 to 4.7, something like that. It's not a wide range. It doesn't sound like a wide range, but if you understand what pH is, you realize it's a logarithmic number. So that's actually a huge difference from 4.3 to 4.7. Okay, it doesn't sound like it as a number, but when you look at it as a logarithmic value and the concentration, it's quite significant. So there are acid tomatoes. Now, the other thing that happens is in all the seed catalogs, almost everybody thinks that the acid tomatoes are the yellow ones. That's a complete myth. Okay, the color of the tomato and the acidity have nothing to do with one another. Right. The second thing that I found out was that the acidity depends very much on where you grow them. So there was a really nice research study where they got like 20 different kinds of tomatoes and they grew them on the same farm so that they could compare them. And they found some were more acidic than others. Then they looked at those same varieties all over the U.S. And they found in certain parts of the country, didn't matter which one you grew, they had the same pH. Okay. In other parts of the country, they had a variety of pHs. So the acidity of a tomato depends on the cultivar and on where it's grown. There are certain parts of the country, like half of the U.S., you cannot grow acidic tomatoes because your soil doesn't allow you to do that. So you have to live in the right state and pick the right cultivar, ignore the color of the tomato, and you can grow tomatoes that are less or more acidic.
Yeah.
So that's the bottom line. It's a little complicated.
Well, there were some other myths that I did want to bring up. A couple that caught my attention. Well, one, on nutrition value, I always thought or was always told that potato skins are more nutritious than the flesh.
Right.
And you say that's not the case.
That's not really the case. There's very little difference between those. And in fact, it turns out that potatoes are actually toxic to us. Right? They have a compound in there called solanine. And that's a toxic compound. In fact, tomatoes, peppers, potatoes, they all have it. They're all in the same family, and they all have this chemical in there. And if we eat too much of it, it can harm us. It turns out that in potatoes, most of that chemical is in the skin. So, in fact, if you want to make your potatoes healthier, they're actually healthier if you take the skin off, because that's where the toxins are. All right. The reality is that most potatoes are quite safe to eat. I mean, if you're going to eat 50 pounds a day, then you may have a problem with this issue, right? But if you eat, you know, a couple potatoes every day, it's not an issue. But yeah, the inside of the potatoes is much more nutritious. And in fact, there's many myths like that. The other one I came across was bananas. You know, bananas have really high calcium levels.
Yeah.
Well, they don't actually have high calcium levels. They're higher than some things, but they're about the same as many of the fruits and vegetables we eat. They're not particularly high in calcium or phosphorus. So many of these things that we think about vegetables are actually turn out not to be quite true.
Our guest today is talking with us about his book. Robert Pavlis, our guest, and the book is Food Science for Gardeners. Questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. We have a comment from David in Madison. He says it's true that we can't see nutrition. For example, when making wine, his nutrition on organic grapes is around 125 parts per million. Drumlin Ridge Winery in town fertilizes, and they test at 500 parts per million for nitrogen.
For nitrogen or for nutrition?
Oh, he said, yeah, I bet it's nutrition. It's coming out nitrogen, but that might have been a spell. You know how that works. Spell checks.
I know how that works. Yeah. So let's look at the one question is, you know, do we have a nutrition number like that? Like he gave a number and said, that's the nutrition number. There is no such thing. Okay. And in fact, this gets back to the first thing we talked about, is that we can't even agree on how to measure nutrition. So until we do that, we can't have a number. There is no such thing as a nutrition number. Now, there is something called a BRICS number. And there are gardening circles where they believe that BRICS is a measure of nutrition. And grapes is one of those areas, okay? And there's a reason why grape growers measure BRICS, but it's not really nutrition. So let's ask the question, what is BRICS? Well, BRICS is a measurement of everything inside the grape. So we squeeze some juice out, we measure it, we get a reading, and it includes everything in there. Unfortunately, 95% of what's in there is sugar. So we're measuring sugar concentration. We're not measuring nutrition. Okay. I can have a grape and I can triple the amount of vitamin C in that grape. I won't see a difference in that number because that number is mostly sugar. And in fact, if I take a grape, I'll get one reading. And if I dry it and turn it into a raisin, I will get a really high reading because now the sugar is concentrated because I lost all the water. So bottom line is BRICS tells us nothing about nutrition. It tells us about how sweet these grapes are, which is a value in the wine industry. So when they're harvesting grapes, they do measure BRICS, and it is important in their processing and so on. So there's value there, but they're measuring sugar, not nutrition. So some gardeners have come along and said, well, geez, it's really easy to measure BRICS. You can buy one of these little meters for $100 and you can go and measure your things. And there's lots of people who think that nutrition and BRICS are the same thing. They're not.
Susan in Appleton has something for us. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Larry.
What's on your mind?
So I'm really curious. Last year, there were so many acorns, it was unbelievable. This year, I haven't seen a single acorn.
Okay, I assume you're talking about the nut.
Yeah.
So this is something that most trees do, fruit trees, nut trees, really any tree, because all trees, of course, are making some sort of a fruit, right? So what they'll tend to do is, they will have a year when they produce a lot, and then the following year or two, they'll produce very little, and then they'll go back and produce a lot again. And they go through this cycle on a regular basis. Okay, so the same thing happens with all your fruit trees. One year you got a booming year, you got all these apples. Next year you got almost nothing. You're wondering, what did I do wrong? Okay, it's has nothing to do with you. In fact, one of the things that's important is to understand that the fruit you get this year on your tree is actually due mostly to the environment the tree had last year. It's not what you did this year. It's the year before. Now, nut trees do this. I mean, all trees do it naturally, but there's another reason why nut trees do it. Okay? There's animals that like that food, and mostly squirrels. Right. So if the trees produce the same amount every year, the squirrels would get most of them and they wouldn't produce very many seedlings. So what these trees do is one year they'll produce so many nuts that the squirrels can't eat them all. And they end up with a lot of seedlings. Remember that the tree's main goal in life is to make babies. So they're producing so many, the squirrels can't eat them all. They produce a whole bunch of young. And then next year, there's this drop. And what happens? Well, the squirrels actually starve to death. And so their population goes down. So for a couple of years, the population drops and drops and drops. And then they throw a huge amount of acorns on the ground again, right? And this is a known cycle that just repeats. And it repeats with most trees. So it's nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with the environment. It's just you're going to have these cycles.
Susan, there you go. Thank you for calling. Margaret in Fort Atkinson, we'll go to you now. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. This is a follow-up question to the growing things inside and the grow light.
Yeah.
What type of light? I've been just using the fluorescent, the LED lights, you know, from Menards. What do you recommend? And what about the temperature for growing like greens
indoors.
In the winter. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So greens like lettuce, for instance, they can grow fairly cool, but they will grow just fine in a normal room temperature. They might do a little better in the basement, though, or if it's a little cooler there. As far as the light goes, the Menard LED type strip lights, they're okay. They will grow low-level plants like lettuce. They're not going to grow high-level plants like tomatoes. Okay. If you really want to grow more food and grow it faster, buy some real LEDs and their grow lights. And the product will tell you two things. One is it will give you the spectra of the light to show you what wavelengths you have. If it doesn't do that, it's not a real grow light. The second thing is that it will tell you how much light it's outputting. And again, you notice a big difference. If you go like on Amazon and you look at some of the cheaper bulbs, they don't give you those two pieces of information, even though they call it a grow light. And without those two pieces of information, you know this is not a real grow light. A real grow light will give you both of those information, and they're critical. But that's the only way to compare two lights and say, okay, this one's stronger than this other one. Okay. For indoor growing, again, you can get away with leafy things. But if you want things to flower and you want larger plants that are taller, you need higher light output.
Yeah. And what would be a number? Is there a number in terms of output that for those higher end plants, let's call them?
Yeah, it's a PPFD value that you're looking for. And you want to be at least at 800.
At least at 800. Okay.
300 will grow lettuce and leafy house door plants. You need at least 500 to start flowering things.
Margaret, there you go. Thank you for calling. Mary in Appleton will go to you next. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have heard, my question is about how microwave heating affects the food. I have heard it destroys vitamins, also the integrity. I've read that at a couple places, and I just can't quite understand. Do you agree with that or disagree?
So one of the myths in the book is about microwaves, and I think there's three microwave myths, and one of them is that it destroys vitamins. Okay, that's a complete myth. So what a microwave is it's actually like a sound wave. So the things you're hearing from me, they're sound waves, and microwaves do the same thing, except the size of the wave is different. Okay? All the microwaves are doing is heating water molecules. The water absorbs those microwaves, and the extra energy that the water collects heats it up. So it's a way of heating water. And in fact, if you take something that's very dry and put it in a microwave, it hardly heats at all because it doesn't have any water in there. It has to have moisture. So what we're really doing when we microwave things is we're in effect boiling them, right? We're doing the same thing as we can do on the stovetop by putting something into a pan and just heating it. That's all microwaves are doing. So it doesn't really degrade food any more than heating will. So you can ask another question. Does heating or cooking degrade nutrition? Like, is fresh better than cooked? And the answer is very complicated. Okay. And the reason the answer is complicated is, remember, we're talking about 5,000 nutritious chemicals here, and they all do different things. So when we heat food, some of these will degrade. Vitamin C, for one, degrades very quickly when we heat it. So if I do it on a stovetop or in a microwave, my vitamin C level goes just down because it degrades with heat. However, heat also creates some other chemicals which are actually good for us. So some of the antioxidants are created when we heat things. So when we're cooking, we kind of get a plus and minus effect. Some of these nutrients will decrease and others will actually increase when we're heating it. Okay? But in general, microwave isn't any worse than cooking on a stovetop.
Okay. Mary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Bob in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Very interesting. When you say that there's no standard for nutrition, measuring nutrition, I'm sure you're not satisfied with that as a scientist. You want to bring out, your goal is to identify what is the most nutritious. And so I'm interested, how do you value nutrition and what is your standard for nutrition and how do you measure it and what can you tell us to look for as consumers?
Mm-hmm. You're not going to like my answer. The answer is that the consumer really has no way to know about the nutrition of the food they're eating. They really have no way to compare two things. The example I had earlier is, what is more nutritious, an apple or an orange? Okay. We don't know. Okay. That's the simple answer. And one of the reasons we don't know that is we don't even know what all the chemical in those two fruits are that are important to us. Okay, we're still learning that. Every year we're finding new chemicals that we think are important in our diet. So we don't know what that list is yet. Now, I know that that goes against everything you've read and all the headlines in newspapers and so on, you know, that say so-and-so is more nutritious and so on. What they do, and when people say that, is they take a very small number of these chemicals and look at them. So we might take the vitamins and say, okay, there's six vitamins. We can say maybe an orange has more total vitamins than an apple. And if we only look at vitamins, it's more nutritious. But what about the antioxidants? Okay, they help us fight cancer. Okay, that's also important. So that's one aspect. There's another aspect here that I think we completely forget. And that is that we can make a list of these nutrients, but we also have to ask, which of these do we need? Okay. And a good example is vitamin C. Everybody talks about vitamin C. You know, we just talked about it. Do microwaves degrade vitamin C? Well, they do. But do we care? Well, it turns out that most people in North America have a diet that actually gives them too much vitamin C. And the excess can't be stored in our bodies. We're not able to hold it. It comes out of our urine. Okay, so eating 10 oranges a day is not going to do you any good. You're not going to have any more vitamins because it just comes out of your urine. Okay, so you now have lots of vitamin C. Should we even consider that as a nutrient that's important for us? And the answer is no, because we don't need any more. Now, if you're in a third world country, vitamin C becomes really important, and that may be more important than a lot of other things. The other ones are the minerals, calcium, phosphorus, and so on. In our diet in North America, we generally get lots of those, partly because we eat a variety of food, partly because a lot of our food is actually enhanced with these. So if you drink milk, you get extra calcium. Phosphorus, I can't remember what it's put in. There's a food we generally all eat, and it has extra phosphorus added. So when we know there's a lack of these, we can actually put it in our food, and we get enough. So in North America, we rarely have a mineral deficiency. So should we care about the mineral content of the food? Maybe antioxidants are more important to us because they're going to help prevent cancer, right? I know you'd like to have a nice answer, but there isn't one. We scientists today still have a long way to go before they can even give you a list and say, these are the things you need to eat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Our guest today, Robert Pavlis, his book, Food Science for Gardeners, Grow, Harvest, and Prepare Nutrient-Dense Food. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Talking today with Robert Pavlis about his book, Food Science for Gardeners, Grow, Harvest, and Prepare Nutrient-Dense Food. Just a quick mention, in the next hour of the show, we'll be talking about growing edible tropical plants in your home. So we'll be looking at that with our next guest. But right now, we're taking a look at Food Science for Gardeners, and Wayne in Hortonville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, got a curious question for you. Wondering about the MythBuster with ash when prepping a soil for gardens. Is it good to put ash from, let's say, a fire pit in there?
Well, that depends. So always go back to the thing you're adding and understand it. So ash is the remains of the stuff that's left after it burns and has lots of minerals in it. So it does have nutrients. So that sounds like a good thing to add to your soil. The problem with ash is it also has a really high pH. So what is the pH of your soil? Where I garden, our pH is 7.4, so it's already alkaline. We're trying to make it a little more acidic because plants love to be around 6.5, right? So in my garden, adding ash only increases the pH, which is not good for plants. So I wouldn't use it. Now, if you're gardening in an acidic soil and you're trying to raise your pH anyways, then ash would be a good choice. There are also some claims about ash getting rid of pests and some things. That really doesn't work. But the ash does have nutrition in it. It's good for the soil, except for the effect on pH.
Yeah. Do you recommend testing your soil?
Well, interesting. Yes and no. So if I lived in the U.S., so by the way, I'm for the listeners, I'm in Canada, on Ontario. In the U.S., your soil test is pretty inexpensive. So if I lived there, I probably would test it more frequently. In the rest of the world, soil tests are quite expensive. Okay, I'll pay 4 or 5 times what you guys pay for a soil test. So it's pretty expensive. Now, there are reasons why I don't recommend a soil test. And the number one reason is that the nutrient that is most likely needed in your soil is nitrogen, and a soil test doesn't test for that. All right. So you get all the other numbers back, and the lab may recommend nitrogen, but they're making a guess. We don't measure nitrogen traditionally in soil. Farmers can do it, and it's an extra expense and so on. But for gardeners, we don't measure nitrogen. That's the nutrient you probably need. So you're missing the main point. The second reason I wouldn't recommend it is that most gardeners don't follow the advice. Okay, so you get your test results, and if it's done in a proper lab, they will say add so much potassium, add so much phosphorus, and so on. To do that, you're going to go to the store and look for fertilizer that has those amounts, and you're not going to find it. You probably have to buy 2 or 3 different fertilizers and mix them together and do all the calculations to figure out how much to add of each one. Gardeners don't do that. They will get frustrated, go to the store and buy a 10-10-10 and spread it around. If you're going to do that, don't waste money on the soil test. And by the way, anyone who's listening, a 10-10-10 is always the wrong fertilizer for your soil. Okay? Yeah. No matter what all those sites are telling you, yeah, Nobody needs a balanced fertilizer. The middle number should almost always be small. Okay, that's the phosphorus. And most soil in North America has lots of phosphorus. We don't need to add more. Okay.
In fact, it's illegal in some areas. The phosphorus isn't even a part of the fertilizers.
That's right. It's been taken out in a lot of places because we don't need it. Now, what I suggest you do is grow stuff. Okay. If the stuff is growing well, don't worry about the soil test. Now, if your plants are not growing well, okay, they have colored leaves, they're short, they're doing something funny, they're not doing well, then you need a soil test. You cannot identify nutrient deficiency by looking at your plants. And again, that's another thing that you'll find all over the internet. You'll find these little memes and diagrams say, well, if it's yellow, it's this and so on. Those are all wrong. You cannot identify nutrient deficiency by looking at your plants. So if they're not growing well, definitely get a soil test.
All right. Let's talk about pesticides for a minute. How concerned should we be about them?
Not nearly as concerned as people are. So there's two key things. One is we do use pesticides in a lot of places. The amount of those pesticides is extremely small. The amount on our fruits and vegetables is extremely small. It's such a low level that it really is not a concern. The other thing that very few gardeners know is that 99.9% of the pesticides you eat are natural. Okay, if you think about it, a plant can't run away from its pests. It just sits there. So the only way it can fight pests is to make toxic chemicals. These are natural pesticides that the plant makes, and they make thousands of these things. So 99.9% of the pesticides you consume come from the plant. That thing that we tell you is nutritious and good to eat is making most of those pesticides. A very tiny amount comes from sprays. Okay. The other way to look at this is that if you look at the synthetic pesticides that you get from all the fruits and vegetables you eat in a whole year, and you look at those that are carcinogens, so we're measuring carcinogens now, you get the equivalent amount in one cup of coffee. Okay, the number of carcinogens in one cup of coffee is about the same as you will consume in a year's worth of fruits and vegetables. And yet we drink coffee every day, sometimes many times a day, and we don't worry about it. And yet when it comes to fruits and vegetables, everyone is so concerned about those pesticides.
There are so many interesting points and myths that you discuss in the book. In our last couple of minutes, what's your favorite one?
Well, one that I spent a fair amount of time understanding is how do tomatoes get ripe?
Yeah.
And let's ask this question. Can you pick an unripe tomato and ripen it on your kitchen counter? All right. And I'll bet 8 out of 10 gardeners will say, no, it has to be vine ripened. And I believe that my whole life. I've been gardening since I was 20, so that's a long time ago. And I always believed that. It had to be good and juicy and red on the vine. If I pick it early, it just won't taste as good. That's a complete myth. Okay? And it has to do with when the plant has ripe fruit or mature fruit. Okay, when that tomato has a little bit of pink coloration, the plant thinks it's finished. The seeds can be harvested at that point and grown. As far as the tomato plant is concerned, that is a mature fruit. All right. Now, as far as humans go and chipmunks go, we want them the red, so we don't eat it at that point. We wait. But if you harvest with a little pink and you bring it inside and let it sit on the counter, don't put it in the fridge. Has to be warm, it will ripen and taste just as good as one that you leave on the vine. Okay. Now, the bonus is that the birds and the chipmunks don't come along and peck at it and chew on it. So you get better tomatoes that way.
There are so many things that we haven't covered in your book, Robert. But I have had a lot of fun talking with you today about it, and I've certainly enjoyed reading your book, and I hope we have a chance to talk again. You raise a lot of very interesting observations that I think a lot of gardeners would say, what?
It was great. I'd love to come back, and I have so many myths. Thousands of them. So we won't run out of things to talk about.
We won't indeed. In the meantime, the book is Food Science for Gardeners: Grow, Harvest, and Prepare Nutrient-Dense Food. We didn't even get to all of that. And it's in the book. So coming up, though, we're going to talk about growing figs, coffee, chocolate right in your house. We'll do that next. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thank you, Robert. Welcome to Garden Talk, Larry here, Mueller here. I can tell you from experience that picking fresh citrus from a tree in Wisconsin in the winter is or summer is a real treat. And today on Garden Talk, we have a tropical houseplant expert with us who can help you do the same thing. With us, he's in Hawaii right now, Byron Martin. Byron is president and co-owner of Logies Plants for Home and Garden. It's a Connecticut business that's been in his family since 1892. They carry fruiting, rare, and tropical plants from all over the world. Byron is also an avid beekeeper. He grows pollinator plants to sustain the local bee population, and has a book out along with his partner on producing, growing fruiting plants in your home. And it's great to have him with us today to talk about this. And what tropical plants would you like to learn more about? Are you interested in growing your own figs or maybe your own black pepper? Having problems with a citrus plant? Join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email to talk@wpr.org. Byron Martin, thank you for getting up early to talk with us from Hawaii. What kinds of plants are you resourcing there?
Well, a lot of the plants we grow are tropical, so we're always on the hunt for new material or things that have been bypassed by time in terms of the plants that we grow. Hawaii, as well as South Florida and areas in Southern California, are places where a lot of the plants that we grow in the greenhouses grow. So that's one of the reasons we're over here. And we're also in the process of developing a nursery here to support some of the growing that's done in Connecticut.
I imagine, transporting, there got to be lots of rules and regulations relating to that.
We have to create a certified nursery to make sure that there's no soil from the ground getting on the plants, which is pest issues. And for all of us that grow plants in the commercial trade, keeping plants clean of insects and diseases is a priority. So it's just part of the whole organization in terms of production.
And tell us about your family business. You've been around, maybe not you since 1892, but your business certainly has a family business. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so it was started in 1892 by my grandfather in the small town of Danielson, Connecticut, that is. And he actually opened a florist shop at that time in a small greenhouse at the present location. And the florist business was what sort of started it. But the plant side of it, the potted plant or container plant side of it, was a sort of a passion of his. And that grew also along with it. In the 1930s, when the second generation had taken on the work, there was this mass collection of tropical or container or what we would call subtropical plants in terms of geraniums and flowering and fragrant plants. We have a citrus plant, a ponderosa lemon, in the greenhouses that was planted in 1900. It's still there today. Those kind of things started taking over, and the business itself, it was, in a small town to try to find enough people to buy these kind of what we would call rare plants. They put out a mailing list, and that was the beginning of our mail order business, which continues today. Particularly, they were plant collectors and passionate about it, as I am myself. And so the collection continued to grow. And over these many years, which is, well over 100 years, there's been a lot of changes. My work has probably focused more on flowering and fragrant plants and the fruiting plants, which, you know, I joined the business late in the process, so I had a chance to see everything that was going on and then put my energies into those things that I found fascinating. And in the world of plants, for those of us that are gardeners, there is never going to be an end to the things that we can find and grow. It's going to take lifetimes to ever get through it all. So it's just an exciting part of life, having always having new plants coming into your possession or to your focus, and then learning how to grow them and getting to know them and so on. And the business today is probably less focused on geraniums and herbs, which my mother was passionate about, and more on fragrant flowering and houseplants, things that grow on windowsills. Now, they did do a lot of houseplant work, because you have to remember that the Victorian age was the time of houseplants, and certainly in the 18 and early 1900s, that was still part of the culture of horticulture, you might say, in terms of what people used. And we do still do a great deal with that, plants that will grow on windowsills. And our work here has been, as I mentioned, related to these different areas. You know, we grow orchids, and my family was really big on begonias. And we still do quite a bit with that. I do some breeding with them still, but, you know, other things have come along. I mean, the fruiting plant book that we wrote, which is Edible Houseplants, is a result of this passion to find container plants or fruiting plants, tropical fruiting plants, things that you'd grow in containers in your home that will actually do well and survive in a home environment. And, you know, we've taken it from there.
Yeah, and it's a dandy book. And on in this state and on this program, many years back, I started a lime tree, a Bear's Lime tree. And my young daughter at the time said, well, we call it Limey. So Limey is well known throughout Wisconsin. And Limey was a very, very productive lime tree. You know, I might have 25 or 30 limes on Limey at any one time. And so there's been a lot of interest. And over time, we've gotten a lot of questions about edible citrus, limes, lemons, and so forth. So it's great. And you feature a lot of plants in your book, some like my limey or limes or lemons, but others that we rarely see. And it's possible, according to you, that, I mean, many of these you will be able to grow in your own home.
Yeah, so the restrictions that we have in terms of growing plants in homes, basically the largest one is light. So there are plants that do well or can do well in lower light. I mean, the best example of that is coffee, which is really a great house plant and a great container plant. And you know, shade-grown coffee. So coffees actually can grow on the understory of trees. And so therefore, in a home environment, they can do well in, you know, a lower light, not dark corner like you grow your philodendrons and many of your aeroids, but in a lower light situation, an east to west window, where they can do quite well and fruit and produce fruit. And the coffee tree is not very large. I mean, in its culture, it can get to be quite a tall tree, but as a container plant, it grows fairly quickly and starts producing fruit at usually 2 or 3 feet in height. So that's a great example of something that has a lot of capabilities, or not necessarily capabilities, but has the structure and the form, and also the you know, the aspect of its growth that fits well into a home. On the other side of that, then you have plants that we know very well as tropicals, which would be like a mango. to, can you actually grow a mango in a home and actually get fruit off of it? And the answer is yes. And what we've done is we've searched out clones or varieties or plants that, you know, have sort of been missed in terms of the market that actually can be grown in a container first. That means that something that can be restricted in its root system and still grow and produce fruit. And then those that will fit into a space that is, 5 feet and under. So that would be a typical plant that you'd grow in a large window. And there are many plants that can be done like that. And some of them are very obscure, like, you know, if I told you the Australian beach cherry, like, how many people know what an Australian beach cherry is? But it's a great plant, and it's just never been brought forward so that people can really see what it does. This is Eugenia ringwoodiana, and that's just an example. And even, you know, I've had so many people comment, like, you can't grow a mango in a house. Well, yes, you can if you get the right variety. And the right variety is a variety called Pickering, which is not a vertical mango, but it's more of a weeper. And that in a container, which they will fruit in a container, can produce fruit. Now, basically, you're not going to have hundreds of mangoes, but our pot, which is about 14 to 16 inches across, will produce 4 or 5 mangoes a year on that one plant.
Our guest, Byron Martin, president and co-owner of Logie's Plants for Home and Garden. We're talking about his book. It's titled Edible Houseplants, Grow Your Own Citrus, Coffee, Vanilla, and 43 Other Tasty Tropical Plants. Well, what I like about your book, and maybe you can explain this further, Byron, is that you've got those varieties that'll work, and you have information on how to successfully grow them.
Right. As I mentioned before, the real key to doing this is light, and whether that's natural light or artificial light, you have to make sure that whatever plant you choose, it has a situation, a light situation that it will thrive in. And, you know, windows, the human eye that senses light in a plant is an entirely different thing. A great example of that is when we take our tropicals in from outdoors and we bring them in into the home, we often, this is particularly with your citrus, like your limey, you'll get a leaf drop. And that is caused by the reduction in light. And even though our eyes pick up that light coming through even that south window, pull back from the window, the plant is actually being exposed to quite a lower light level than it would if it was grown outside. And it doesn't hurt it any. You just have to remember that this is a response, and then the plant stabilizes.
It essentially, like limey, would grow thicker leaves. You know, the leaves basically change. A lot of the leaves fall off, and the new leaves that come in are different looking.
Right, and that's the plant's making a bigger leaf, a thicker leaf, to try to capture more of that lower light.
We had Kyle in La Crosse emailed, and sort of in honor of my limey, they purchased the Persian Bear's lime bush. Is there any pruning that needs to be done to keep it healthy? It's done really well until recently when it dropped quite a few of its green leaves, and we now know why that, you know, obviously that happened. Kyle fertilizes with a citrus-specific food monthly and only waters when the top few inches are dry. Got plenty of southwest-facing sun and has a grow light to supplement as well. Well, what about pruning?
Yeah, so that sounds like a great place to grow. And Kyle, I think you're doing actually a good job. You've got it down. The pruning is something that you just need to do to head the plant back, shape it up. You know, you get a long leaf that reaches out. That doesn't want to have fruit on it, and it makes it look kind of asymmetrical, so you chop that off. The pruning on citrus, limes, for going back a step, limes and lemons grow twice as fast as a edible citrus like a tangerine or an orange or a grapefruit. They have a, they just continue to grow, whereas the edible, other edible citrus or even ornamentals tend to have a seasonal growth and then it stops. So, and then the growth that generally we have flowering on citrus in late winter, early spring, that's the flowering cycle form. But lemons and limes can do it off cycle and they'll flower even in summertime. So when you're pruning citrus, you have to remember there's these two differences in terms of the flowering structure or flowering time, and then you do the pruning according to that. So if you prune in winter, like right now going into winter, you're going to probably be cutting a lot of your flowers off. And and then to reshape a plant, it doesn't matter if there's flowers out on the end of that long branch that makes it irregular, you just chop that off because you don't want it anyway to have fruit on the end. And you're, again, you're trying to make that symmetrical structure to it. So basically with citrus, you just do the pruning, usually after flowering, so you've seen where all your fruit's going to set, and then you prune the plant back.
Byron Martin, our guest today, the book that he wrote along with his wife, Laura Lynn, is titled Edible Houseplants, Grow Your Own Citrus, Coffee, Vanilla, and 43 Other Tasty Tropical Plants. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and great to have you along today on WPR News for Garden Talk. Always wonderful to have you listening in, and today we talk with Byron Martin, president and co-owner of Logie's Plants for Home and Garden, and co-author of the new book, Edible Houseplants, Grow Your Own Citrus, Coffee, Vanilla, and 43 Other Tasty Tropical Plants. Andrea in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Andrea.
Hi there. I just wanted to say when the Logie's catalog arrives, oh my goodness, what an array of temptations for any gardener. It is appalling. So thank you very much for sending that out and raising my spirits on a regular basis. I did want to talk and put a word in for figs, because even if you don't have a bright, sunny window in the winter, you can grow figs and have figs during the summertime because you can put them to bed for the winter. Right now, I'm letting my figs that have dropped their leaves, I'm cutting them back a little bit, and then I'm going to put them into a basement, a garage, any place where it's going to stay around 50 degrees or lower, not freezing, dark, cool, water them once a month, and then next summer, figs all over the place. Oh, my goodness.
Andrea, thanks for going. Comment, Byron.
Well, that's the way to do it. Figs do are deciduous, although not so if it's warm, really warm. And they can be, once they've dropped their leaves, obviously they don't need light. And it's about keeping them cool, as you mentioned, but also not freezing them. They can take a little bit of freezing in a container, but you don't want to go down too low on that. And, of course, in Wisconsin, you get some pretty severe winter weather. And then in the springtime, you move them outside when the danger of frost is gone by. Even if they've started to flush some growth and the growth is kind of white and pale, you can put them out and they'll readjust to that. They go back into growth. And then the figs appear for another cycle. So, yeah, figs are great plants for containers. There are other ways of actually wintering them over. There's also the wrapping method, and I'm not sure about the severity of Wisconsin weather, but if you can insulate them some, you can actually keep them outside in an area that is below freezing and just protect them from that severe, severe cold. So figs actually can take freezing. You know, they can go up to zone 8 in terms of the temperature drops. But yes, as container plants, they're great. We actually do just what you do, except we have cold frames that we move our container plants into for the winter. And even though there's light in those cold frames, they drop all their leaves because we hover the temperature just around freezing throughout the winter. Of course, in the warmer days, it goes higher than that. And then the key is that once you get that plant container grown and you move it out, you've actually made a jump on the season. And so you reliably get fruit. Whereas if you do grow them in the ground wrapped, there's this problem with the enough warmth throughout the summer, that's degree days, to actually bring the fruit to ripening. And here in Connecticut, we're up against, or we're not up against, but we're near the ocean. Our temperatures probably are not as hot as they are in the interior of the country during the summertime. You know, we're talking about really, really hot, hot weather. During the summer, that actually gives the degree days to ripen the fruit. So containers work actually better here in our area than they do planted in the ground in terms of fruit production. Yeah, good idea.
Andrea, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Joe in Madison, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
You can easily sprout a avocado pit.
But will it? Yeah, but you're wondering, will it ever produce? And Joe, you, I think you've got comments on that in your book.
Yeah. So the problem with it is it takes a very long time for an avocado. Avocados from pits, even in tropical areas, take years before they'll come into fruit. And when we get ourselves in the north, it's going to be years and years and years. And to do it in a container, because they are very vigorous, large growing plants, is really problematic. So what we do is we graft them. And grafting often, most times, speeds up the fruiting cycle, because what you're doing is you're taking a rootstock, that's your seedling, and you're putting a piece of graft tissue, which is a scion, that is already in the cycle of fruiting. So we take these off of mature trees that are in the fruiting, have already begun to fruit, and we graft it onto it, and that shortens the time between the start of the rootstock and the time when an avocado will stop producing fruit. That said, even in containers, avocados that are grafted take quite a few years before they start to fruit. You got to get a fairly big trunk on that container plant before it starts producing fruit. It can take, you know, 5 to 6 years or even more before, and they'll flower, but they don't fruit until they get some real time put in on it. It's a very interesting process to be able to grow from seed plants and in containers and bring them to fruit. And we do that quite frequently here at Logi, especially when we're trialing new products or, excuse me, new plants. One would be an example of the Eugenia candoliana, which is the rainforest plum. It's a plant that we brought seed in from about 6 or 7 years ago. And when we planted it, obviously seedling, it took about 3 years before we started getting fruit off of it on those that we kept bumping up into bigger plants. The plants got up to be about 5 feet in height. We held some of those plants back in very small containers, probably 4-inch pots. They didn't grow very much. And they did eventually flower, which is very interesting, and fruit. And we have them in fruit right now. The plants are just going through a fruiting cycle. Mm-hmm. And the plants only got to be about 2 feet tall rather than 5, but it took probably 3 extra years of that restriction on that young seedling before it decided it got old enough to begin fruiting. And that's actually the process, is the plant gets so big that the vascular system gets not necessarily stressed, but expanded to a point where the plant actually decides it's old enough to actually stop producing flower buds. And we see this on many, many plants that, you know, there were some stories that some of the old breeders would actually take plants that were seedlings and they'd wrap copper wire around the base of the trunk, sort of like girdling it, to try to reduce the amount of water that's going up, restrict it to make the plant think that it's older. And I guess to some degree it works. I've tried it and haven't been very successful with it, but there's some literature, old literature, that will actually direct you and put you in that direction to do that. So that's the process. Avocados, basically, it's going to take years.
There you go, Joe. Thank you for calling. Pat in Stoughton, we'll go to you. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I've had a Meyer lemon plant for probably about, I don't know, 15 years or so. I've been getting about 6 to 12 fruit on it every year, but I've had scale for the last like 6 years, and I've done everything I can think of to get rid of it, and I'm almost ready to give up. I've used neem oil. I put it outside and sprayed it. I clean it by hand like at least once a week. Do you have any advice before I get rid of it? The honeydew stuff is killing me.
Yeah.
They, scale can be pretty bad, but there's no reason you can't control it. So my question would be, when you use the neem oil, was it pure neem oil that you diluted in water and then emulsified with soap?
I've done both.
So oils work really well on scale. The key is you have to get complete coverage and you have to do repeated sprayings.
So
are you doing that?
I have tried that. I've taken it outside and sprayed it a bunch with the neem oil. I've used straight neem oil on the leaves and, like I said, cleaned it by hand. It just seems resistant to it.
No, so now the question is, are these scales little brown bumps that you see?
Yeah.
I mean, there's many types of scales. So you have what we call the common greenhouse scale.
Okay.
And there's many, many types of scale, by the way. There's probably dozens, if not hundreds of different types of scale that get on plants. So that little brown bump that you see is not a live scale. That's a dead scale. And underneath that bump, if you push that bump off and you look at it with magnification, you'll see either eggs, and lots of them, they're very, very tiny, or you'll see these live crawlers. And those crawlers move out from underneath that protected shell off onto the leaf. You can't see them, they're tiny. And then they attach themselves, they go through a mating process, but they attach themselves to the leaf somewhere out in a crack or on the bottom, usually on the bottom side of the leaf. And they become what we call soft shell. And that's not really easy to see, but if you look at it, you'll see these little scales that are sitting on the leaf. And then that soft shell scale, that's the female. She feeds on the plant, producing the honeydew that's such a pain. And then eventually she matures into this brown bump in which she lays her eggs and the cycle begins again. When it's under the brown bump, it's almost impervious to pesticides, whatever you're using. When the scale, those little crawlers come out, and this goes over many, many weeks. It's not a fast process as reproduction is with many insects. When that little crawler goes out onto the leaf, it's very vulnerable. You could probably kill them with soapy water. But it happens over a long period of time, weeks and weeks and even months, those little crawlers come out. And then when they turn into that scale, that soft shell stage, they're also extremely vulnerable, particularly to oils like neem oil or ultrafine horticultural oils. Those are both work very well. But the problem is that somewhere on that plant, after you've gone through the spraying process, there's a brown bump that is not, that is harboring those eggs or crawlers. And then when you stop that spraying process, they reinitiate infection again. So we really don't have problems with scale too much in the greenhouses anymore. But in the older days, before the neem oil came along and these oils, these ultrafine oils, and the ultrafine oils, by the way, are oils that don't damage plants as bad as the material that you spray on your apple trees when they're dormant. Those things can cause a lot of damage. But these oils are more adaptable to green leaf plants. And we started doing it, but we spray every week, once a week, thoroughly covering the plant with this oil material, and you're going to do that 3 times, 4 times, 5 times. And in between the spraying, you're going to wash the oil off because that buildup can cause damage. And if you do that with neem oil, and by the way, the neem oil wants to go in at 1.5 to 2 tablespoons of oil per gallon with 1 teaspoon to 2 teaspoons of dishwashing detergent. And that detergent's going to emulsify it so it spreads onto the leaf. And if you do that, you will eventually get past that. Now, that said, you've got to make sure you get absolute 100% coverage of the plant. Because if you miss one of those little brown bumps, which they can be anywhere along the stems, that reinfection starts again. But we have, and this is years ago, we successfully, our mother lemon tree, and for all of you that have been to Logies, we have this kumquat tree that's probably 160 years old. And that thing used to be, when I first started working in the business in the early 70s, that used to be like a haven for scale, and we don't have scale on it anymore. It's gone.
Oh. Pat, there you go. You got some a little bit of work ahead of you there, but good luck. Appreciate your call very much. You know, Kat in Green Bay emailed us, speaking of lemons. She has a young lemon tree Kat bought earlier this spring, brought it inside about 3 to 4 weeks ago. It's now in full bloom, which is very exciting and makes their guest room smell great. What can they do to support it over winter? They do need to repot it since it's in its original container, and is now a good time to do that?
The answer is no.
No, he's right.
The reason for that is we're going into the hardest time for plants everywhere, right? Our light level's low, growth is going to stop, even though there's flowers on it, which is a little early. That may be due to some stress on the plant. But what you're trying to do is get that plant between here and February without it being stressed too much. And the biggest issue with growing citrus inside, other than reduced light, and we've already talked about that, is the root disease or keeping a healthy root system. Citrus is very prone to root diseases or root rot. And this is the time of year when the plants are under very low light, the vigor in the plant is down, it's not growing. And if that soil is kept too moist, you want to make sure that if it is kept too moist, then root diseases can become a problem. And you want to make sure that there's a good dry down. I remember one of the callers earlier on had talked about how he took care of his citrus, allowing the soil to dry. So when you repot that, you're going to put it into a mass of wet soil that the roots are not connected to, and that high moisture level can cause damage. So the best thing to do is leave the plant just where it is. It seems to be happy now. Just continue your watering cycle, which is bringing the surface of the soil to dryness or even a little beyond. Thoroughly saturate it. Generally, we don't recommend fertilizing in the wintertime because we're not trying to force growth. We're just trying to maintain. And there's going to be this point in the springtime when all of a sudden it's going to come back to life. The light level is increased. The plant's recognizing that. And now the leaves, and don't forget, the top of the plant is a mirror of the bottom of the plant. That root system is going to start to grow, and that's the time to bump it up into a bigger pot. And I generally recommend clay rather than plastic for growing citrus. And the reason for that is clay gives you a quicker dry down. And yes, you have to water it more, but that's a good thing. So you bump it up into a clay pot, terracotta, not glaze, so the plant can actually breathe and then go forward from there.
Yeah. Oh, excellent advice. Kat, thank you very much for that email. Excuse me, you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Byron Martin, our guest, co-owner of and president of Logies Plants for Home and Garden, and his new book is Edible Houseplants: Grow Your Own Citrus, Coffee, Vanilla, and 43 Other Tasty Tropical Plants. Here on Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at the new book out there, Edible Houseplants, Grow Your Own Citrus, Coffee, Vanilla, and 43 Other Tasty Tropical Plants, with the co-author of the book, Byron Martin, who is president of Logies Plants for Home and Garden. great to have Byron with us. And again, you can join in. I hope you do. Questions or comments, the number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Vicki in Eau Claire, quite a bit earlier, had wanted to mention a useful science-based website with information about LED grow lights. And the website Vicki recommends is happyleafled.com, happyleafled.com. Are you familiar with that site, Byron?
I'm not. I really haven't delved too much into the LED light world, although we do use them in the greenhouses to force production or to disrupt day length. But there's a lot of information out there, and that one site certainly probably would be very useful. People often ask us about, you know, artificial light, and the world has changed since LEDs came in. And the other thing that's changed is the cannabis industry, which has brought, you know, horticulture into large warehouses where they actually, you know, are producing a very, very high light plant. And so that's given, in terms of those of us that are indoor gardeners or light gardeners, a lot of information on what we need to do to, you know, really give that outdoor effect indoors. And I also, I often recommend people, if you're trying to use LED lights, go to the cannabis industry, find out what they're doing, and then replicate it.
Okay. Would you tell us, you know, we've sort of talked a bit about your book, but tell us again what everything, or what all people are going to find when they get your book, Edible Houseplants.
Well, it's really an information-based book. So what we did was we took our plant collection of container fruiting plants, and then we created the book with photographs and information on how to grow them. So it's not really a book that you might want to sit down and read for a story. It's really just information and what we know about them and what we've done to be successful in growing them. And I mean, I'll say this again, that light is the biggest factor in indoor culture for whatever plant you're growing, including fruiting plants. In that world of fruiting plants, you have to remember that some things actually need to get big before they'll do something. We mentioned avocados. They have to grow to be, we actually keep our container avocados under 5 feet. But that's fairly large for somebody that only has a 3-foot window. But there are plants that would sit in that 3-foot window easily and produce a lot of high quality fruit. And I did mention before the Australian beach cherry, which is Eugenia rimwardiana, is a wonderful little plant that produces hundreds of little bright red cherries. And there's actually, it's similar to cherries, and it has a big seed inside. And they're very sweet and delicious, but it can stay quite small. Another plant that we grow as a container plant that's fruiting is the Malpighia, which is the acerola berry. And that plant, although it grows into a probably a 10, 12-foot bush if planted in the landscape, can be maintained in pots or containers under 3 feet. So that would fit in the smaller window. And then, of course, we talked a lot about citrus. Citrus are great container plants. And they doesn't even have to be a lemon. I mean, lemons and limes are very productive, as Liney has shown to you. But, you know, citrus, pretty much all citrus can be grown in containers and fruit very well. And, yes, you know, smaller things like a key lime produce tons of fruit, whereas if you grow a grapefruit, you may only get 4 or 5 on a plant. But, you know, it's all relative to the size of the fruit and the plant itself.
And the varieties are quite important.
Oh, yeah. And there's so many citrus. We just started growing pomelo. I don't know how many of your listeners here are familiar with it, but that is actually the source, one of the parents of our common grapefruit. And it's a huge fruit. I mean, if you see them in the supermarkets, they're, you know, they're like the size of a well, a small soccer ball or something like that, you know. I mean, they're huge. And we've grown them over the years, but we got in a variety called Chandler, which we grew it out, we fruited it, and it's really super sweet. That's the other thing is, like, you know, the quality of the fruit grown in the window as opposed in the north as opposed to being grown in a subtropical climate. But the fruit was super sweet, and it has this very thick rind to it. Well, our Chandler Pomelo, which we've grown to just about, well, with a pot on it, it's probably 5 feet. It's almost as a little under my height, has about 6 fruit on it, but they're huge. I mean, they're these great big round balls, and it's a lot, it was a lot of fun growing it. And it turned out to be a great citrus, very vigorous. It has the whole plant is just large. So the leaves are larger, the branches are larger. That's probably going to be, you probably could fruit it, maybe get a few fruit in a 3-foot window, but you're probably going to need more space than that. In terms of height to produce it. But citrus are just great plants overall. And once you get that watering cycle down and the light cycle down, and obviously controlling the insects, which if you're isolated, you generally don't see the insects. So in other words, if the plant comes in clean and you don't have a lot of other plants around that, this is an example of scale, you're probably going to be okay. But, you know, if you have infected plants nearby, then obviously bugs can get on. Scale don't travel as fast as like whitefly or spider mite, but they do travel. And so then you just need to make sure, like with all citrus, you get your watering down, you get your light down, and it's pretty much the same culture right through for all of them. And we talk about pruning. That was a great question. And then doing your proper pruning to maintain them.
Jill in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jill.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious. I have some raspberry bushes in my backyard, and it's not a huge plot of them, but they were originally from my grandmother's house, and I've had them producing fruit since the spring all the way until September, and I even ate some off of there yesterday. So kind of a strange growing cycle from my understanding of raspberries, and I don't know if it's something that I should try to mitigate because it's going to harm the plant, or if I just celebrate and eat all the raspberries all year long.
Celebrate raspberries all year long. They're a temperate plant. There's everbearing, so they have multiple cycles of fruiting, and you probably got that one, which I guess it was your grandmother who probably made a good choice on that. So I would just keep doing what you're doing. Are they in containers?
No, they're planted in the ground.
They're in the ground.
Oh, yeah. Don't worry about it. So they make their canes. Generally, their canes are made this year for fruiting next year. And so, those old canes that have fruited, you can cut those out next spring or in the wintertime. And then it goes through that cycle. And the ever-bearing ones generally flower later in the year. I mean, I think some growers actually prune them back to force that growth, because they fruit the first year, that the ever-bearing one will fruit late in the year, which is probably what you've got. But you're doing the right thing. Just keep doing it.
Thanks, Jill. Chess in Madison, your turn. Hi, Chess.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I have a loquat tree that I grew from seed 35 years ago, and it's very vigorous, large leaves, about 6 by 6. It has never blossomed, and I'm wondering why. Do you have any suggestion how I can get it to blossom so we could maybe get a fruit?
Okay, so the question is, do you ever prune it?
I do.
Okay, so the cycle on that is, like our loquats right now, we grow them in containers. We're doing the same thing. Ours are usually grafted, so we get a colonial variety. But loquats obviously will fruit from seed, and certainly they should have done it by now. So my thought is that you're probably pruning your flowers off. So what time of year do you prune?
Well, I only prune when it gets leggy and it's maybe every 2 or 3 years. I put them outside for 4 months in the summer and then put them in a south-facing sunroom for the rest of the year.
Okay. Hmm. So that wouldn't explain it. That wouldn't explain it. Because you've given them 2 years of growth. It's like usually if you prune back, if you have a fruiting plant and the limbs, flowers, and you chop it back, it's going to go into this vigorous growth that's going to skip a fruiting cycle, which is 1 year. Like our loquats right now are all in bud, so or coming into bud. They do that in the wintertime. This is actually budding season, and they're starting to flower and the fruit setting so that, you know, in the springtime, it's when, or in our case, late winter, is the time when they will start producing edible fruit. You know, the fruit just starts to ripen. So it's 6x6. How big is the container?
It's about 5 gallons, ma'am, maybe 8 gallons.
Okay, that's fine. That's perfect. And... do you fertilize it at all?
Not only with coffee grounds.
Okay. But, you know, so the growth cycle right now is stopped. Light level's low. It's going into flower. You can, under warm conditions, you could probably have some growth coming along. But if it's cool, everything stops. And then... in the springtime, it's going through its fall, it starts to grow again like every other plant. I hate to say that it could be nutritional, but it could. And that's just kind of a tricky question because the plant's still growing. So, you know, what's the deal, right? The things that produce, the plant's old enough to flower, so you don't have to worry about that. At that age, the plant should have been flowering for years. The thing that will reduce it is, and this doesn't mean you're not doing it, is light. It's also pruning, but you're letting that go for a couple of years, so you don't have to worry about that. And then there's nutrients. And, you know, we always have told that the high middle number phosphorus produces flowers. So you're not even getting flowers. Forget about the fruit. So we first have to get flowers. The middle number, which is phosphorus, will produce fruit or will produce flowers, and that to some degree is true and not. But the fact that you're only giving it coffee grounds means that it's not getting, because coffee grounds are not complete plant nutrition. No. You need to stop feeding it, and it may take a year before you get to the point where it starts to decide it's got enough. So the plant isn't getting something. Right? So the first thing it does is just grow and keeps its leaves. The second, the last thing it does is it tries to reproduce, and that's flowering. So my suggestion would be don't prune it as much as you can. If you have to just to get it into the house, reduce it at all, but don't prune it like shave it. Just take selected leaves off to make it fit and start fertilizing it with a balanced fertilizer. And don't need to do it now. It's the wrong time of year. But in the springtime, it starts to grow. And then grow it through the season with that, remembering that the first number in your fertilizer is nitrogen that produces leaves, and you're doing that fine. Those last two numbers, which are phosphorus and potash, are the ones that help induce flowering. So you want to make sure that you're not overdoing your nitrogen on this fertilizing cycle and increasing those last two numbers and see if it doesn't make a difference. But as I said, it's going to take a year or two before you can get that cycle in sync.
Jess, thank you so much. Byron, thank you so much. We are out of time, but I hope we can do this again. I hope you'll be with us maybe when you're back in Connecticut. His book is Edible Houseplants, Grow Your Own Citrus, Coffee, Vanilla, and 43 Other Tasty Tropical Plants. Great show. And we have a great team, producers Clara Neipert and Joel Padnott, our technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.